I just feel that it needs that the perspective is too strong on the buildings behind for this, that we need to have something a bit flatter. The bottom.
From Christea Roberts Gallery, welcome to Making a Mark, a podcast series exploring the relationship between artists and printmaking. Today, Richard Hamilton, the founding father of pop art in Britain and one of the most influential artists of his generation.
I am a figurative artist. That means that I need subject matter, human subject matter, and sometimes human subject matter of a very powerful nature, something that really touches the emotion, touches the heart, whether it makes a value judgment or not, it should touch and move its audience.
He was a draftsman by training, so printmaking in all of its forms, from the simplest to the most complex, intrigued that engineer in him from the beginning.
I'm Michael Bracewell. I'm a writer and the author of Modern World, The Art of Richard Hamilton.
My name's Alan Christea, and I started working with Richard in the mid-70s. We worked together basically from then until his death in 2011. I mean, I like to think of him as a friend. That's the main thing. But aside from that, I was responsible for distributing all the editioned prints that he made. So in any media, and believe me, there were a lot of media. So that was my principal role. Richard didn't like to sell paintings to anybody except museums. So the prints were, you know, his main source of income.
I think that I always felt when I saw Hamilton's work when I was very young, when I was a teenager, that feeling that it shared with pop, this sense of urgency, that it was confrontational, that it was exciting.
I mean, he kind of defined pop culture. And that's where I started. But of course, he was multifaceted. I mean, he was the only person who really understood completely what Marcel Duchamp had done. He was a James Joyce scholar. He really was multifaceted.
I met Richard Hamilton a handful of times before his death, and it was Alan who introduced us. He'd been friends with Richard for decades by then. They met long before Alan opened his own gallery, when he was working for another organisation, the Waddington Gallery, owned by art dealer Leslie Waddington.
And I was constantly trying to persuade Leslie Waddington to allow me to work directly with Richard. But I finally managed to persuade him to go and visit Richard. And it was a very amusing meeting because I went with Leslie, and Richard opened his front door. He was then living in Archway. And Leslie said, "Oh, the reason we're here is entirely because of Alan, because I actually don't like your work." Which, unfortunately, Richard had a huge sense of humour, and that just cracked him up. I mean, he was always known to be a perfectionist and thus quite difficult, but I never found him so. And we happened to go on the day when he had just finished signing the edition of our print called Picasso's Meninas. The stack of the whole edition was literally sitting on a table. And I was so captivated by this image. It was a reinterpretation of Velázquez via Picasso. The thing about it was that he'd been asked to contribute a print to a portfolio in homage to Picasso. And normally when an artist is asked to do something like that, most of them would, you know, just somehow do a version of what they were working on in any case and leave it at that. Whereas Richard had stipulated, he'd said, "Fine, I will contribute to the portfolio as long as I can work with Picasso's intaglio printer a man called Aldo Comelac, who was based in Paris. And then he set out to use all the techniques that Picasso had practiced with Comelac over a period of 20, 30 years and incorporate them in one print. And it took a long time to resolve, clearly, but he did it. Okay, well, I've got a catalogue in front of me. So Picasso's Meninas incorporates hard and soft ground and stipple etching, open bite and lift ground aquatint, engraving, dry point and burnishing. And I mean, it would be impossible for me to sit here and give you a description of all those different techniques. So you have to take my word for it that, you know, that is a very difficult feat to accomplish. And that's where the relationship really started.
Hamilton created great images which sort of transcend the medium they're in, which means that his prints are actually just as powerful as his paintings. They intertwine with each other. Sometimes it's hard to tell, you know, a painting from a print.
The Guardian's art critic, Jonathan Jones.
In his paintings, he uses found images. And then he's also fascinated by the process of printmaking. I mean, you know, printmaking goes back to the Middle Ages, late Middle Ages, 15th century. And yet it's been one of the... It's been surprisingly central to modern art. Picasso and Matisse used it very well. The pop era is interested in the reproduction of images and in the nature of an image and what makes an image powerful. That's what Warhol was doing as well. And Hamilton in England is the person who does that most trenchantly and seriously. And he's, but he also has an instinct for the powerful image. So he captures the image, he comes back to the image, he reworks the image, he rethinks it. And it can sound a bit, that can sound a bit dry almost, but it's not. The results are never very rare. They're not dry. They're actually very powerful, because I think what you have with Hamilton is great emotional, imaginative power contained within a very intelligent, analytical approach. It's the tension between the two, you know, that makes it fascinating.
My name is Jill Headley. I worked twice with Richard Hamilton when I was at the British Council as curator of an exhibition, two exhibitions that he did as part of the São Paulo Bienal in Brazil, and then a couple of years later when he had the British Pavilion at the Venice Biennale. His drawings and his early etchings in the simplest and most classic form make perfect sense in a line of work that went up to computer-generated images as the technology allowed him. He was also very inventive and in that collaged way used different methods of printmaking, classic methods of printmaking, but putting them together in one work in a way that was very unusual. So the toaster series, for instance, using different forms of printing and then collaging a mirrored surface to the image so that that glossiness of kitchen equipment, shininess, and the tactile quality that, you know, in drab post-war Britain became so compelling.
Anyone who thinks abstract artists are too abstract should drop in at the Whitechapel Art Gallery, where there's an exhibition devoted to collaboration between architects, painters and sculptors. They point out that yesterday's tomorrow is not today, so maybe today's tomorrow won't be quite what you expected.
From the early 50s, Richard Hamilton had been one of the principal members of the Independent Group, a small gathering of artists and theorists whose meetings were held under the auspice of the Institute of Contemporary Arts in London. In 1956, they held an exhibition at the Whitechapel Gallery called This Is Tomorrow.
The basis of it was to get various groups, each consisting of three people, an artist, a designer, and an architect, working together. And actually, in Richard's case, the most lasting image actually came in the form, really, of what was supposed to be a poster to advertise the exhibition. you know, the This Is Tomorrow exhibition. And that little poster incorporated all the elements of what was to become known as pop art, including the word pop.
Richard called it, "Just What Is It That Makes Today's Homes So Different, So Appealing?"
I understand it's still the most reproduced 20th century work of art. I don't know whether that claim is still true. It's a tiny little thing made up of images culled from, cut out from a whole range of magazines. And you've got Atlas, Adam and Eve, an interior with aspirational products and an intense conglomeration of contemporary elements. It was meant as an illustration and therefore perhaps travelled more widely in its impact than if it had just been something on the wall. It was a knowing, witty, clever distillation of everything that was pop, as in popular.
It was the result of an attempt to sit down and assess the situation. And it certainly was a turning point in my life, because I then began to say, well, if this is what's important, then I must paint something that reflects this relationship of an artist to society. And so ever since then, I've been rather careful to think before I do anything, is this expressing our time in a meaningful kind of way, or is it something that's merely decorating the surface of our life?
He never looked down on pop culture. He never looked down on mass culture. In fact, he was, if anything, in awe of the technicians and artisans who created the raw material of pop culture. I mean, he actually understood that in Hollywood, there would be somebody whose job it was to align a light in such a way that when it hit a sequin at a particular angle, it would sparkle with a particular radiance that a camera then had to be able to pick up to communicate 6 feet across on a huge cinema screen.
He was aware of the impact of the American dream, the curvy car, the curvy women, the curvy refrigerators, that seductive element of the shape of consumer objects and the way that advertising made comparisons between sexy women and supposedly sexy cars. And this was all manipulation of image. Taking the traditional elements of Western art, which mattered enormously to Hamilton, the interior, the still life, the portrait, the storytelling, what you know used to be called history painting, but the telling of stories. He worked through his career through that canon of subject matter, but brought it absolutely bang up to date by introducing, like, Just What Is It? A view of the interior being today's interior, the still life, his series of toasters, the portrait, an interrogation of what makes an image in My Marilyn.
Encountered for the first time in the Tate Gallery in London in the early 1970s, Hamilton's My Marilyn was, to my young eyes, sexy but edgy. A mass media mashup of crossings out and semi-obliterated and degraded images, like a dream or what I imagined an acid trip might resemble, somehow telling you that Marilyn Monroe had left the building once and for all. It looks like a kind of a series of almost like comic book panels, but like the way that a comic book story is told in cells, you know? And yet they're photographic images of Marilyn Monroe on a beach in a bikini. She is also both advancing towards us as the viewer and retreating from us. So you have a sense that sort of she's coming towards you and going away simultaneously. And the whole thing is in this kind of slight sort of almost like a bubblegum pink. And the images in this case are, of course, George Barris's photos of Marilyn Monroe, supposedly the last photo shoot with Marilyn. And, you know, what Richard was interested in was the fact that, you know, these images had been marked up for, they'd been vetted and approved by Marilyn for publication, which is something she always did, apparently. She wanted to check the images herself, which is a kind of quite a modern thing to do.
And she made the decision, controlling her image, maintaining the iconic status, and decided which ones were in or which ones were out. In, a tick, out, a quite big cross, as in, not as in a little neat cross at the bottom left-hand corner, but a slash. I do not want these images of me.
The fact that she'd erased these different images personally and left the one where she's smiling, it was almost an acknowledgement that she'd become an object that, when represented in a certain way, it was acceptable to her and to the world. But I got this sensation that it was masking a great deal of tragedy. Now, maybe that was because she died in the way she did. But I think it is, you know, it's there in that picture that the tragedy is intimated by the way that Richard has presented it. But also to present it in those lurid colours is somehow the intimation that those colours were inflicted upon her rather than being part of her. The colours of a mediation that the outside world wanted to see. And it's very subtle. It's not like staring at a Warhol Marilyn, you know. I mean, the Warhol aspect is, okay, everybody loves Marilyn, so I'll give you Marilyn.
Warhol collected rather ghoulishly images of movie stars and celebrities and things, and he did it like a fan, you know. He was like somebody ordering loads of fans' stuff. But then he also had this very bulimic attitude that on the one hand he wanted to kind of get as much of his idols as possible, but he wanted it to be emptied out. He says, I want it to be, keeps on saying, I want the image to be emptied out. Whereas Richard was the total opposite. Richard was filling in the image. Richard was kind of putting its psychology into it. He was heightening the psychology, you know. Somebody says somewhere that my Marilyn is also, it's a threnody, it's a funereal piece, because it's a look really not just at, you know, Marilyn when as a sort of vivacious and, you know, glamorous film star, it's looking at her as a ghost.
It is a difference between, you know, the way things were done in America and the way things were done in London. Somehow, in England, pop art, so-called, was always a more detailed affair than it was in, a more subtle affair than it was in America.
Warhol shows you what it looks like. Hamilton contributes to an understanding of why it looks like that.
Art director and graphic designer Peter Saville.
He was like one of the gods on Mount Olympus to me. And I do distinctly remember coming across a book in actually the graphics library of Manchester Polytechnic when I was on foundation. And there's a sort of little slim book. Actually, let me just get it. I'll show you the book. It will help. Oh, it's just Richard Hamilton, and it's the Tate Gallery, 1970. 12th of March to 19th of April, 1970. So it's a hardbound catalogue for a show at the Tate. Whilst flipping through this book, I saw Toaster, which is effectively, or seemingly, a layout from a product catalogue, from a Braun catalogue. There's an image of a particular toaster that Dieter Rams designed. There's an image of sort of slightly reductive, slightly abstracted into sort of two-dimensional planes. And then underneath it is three columns of sans-serif text setting. The point was, though, that this appeared to be a graphic composition without irony, where the rigor and discipline of visual art, fine art, product design, graphic design, photography, could meet equally, actually in a new kind of work of art, in the oeuvre of Hamilton. It placed this idealized target in my mind, that basically in our tangible, accessible experience of the everyday, art could be realized.
It's making, you know, the best possible use of that combination of offset lithography and screen printing. The kind of coup de grace is the metallic foil on the toaster. That metallic foil really acts as a mirror. It's so that you are actually in some ways buying a picture of yourself. I have one that he did towards the end of his life, hanging in my office permanently. And literally people who walk into my office, obviously not this year, but people who walk into my office and they look at it and they quite often, you know, kind of adjust their hair or check their appearance in one way or another by staring at this object that was designed to appeal to the elegant branch of society who wanted to identify themselves with the modern, with the contemporary.
The hero of the piece is Dieter Rams. And the idea of actually doing things well because you can. I mean, you could buy a Braun alarm clock for £20. And it gave you pleasure. I have a Braun calculator from the 80s. It is a delight. But also it's a kind of it's a milestone. That toaster is a milestone. It's a milestone in civilization.
As Baudelaire wrote in the 19th century, that, you know, the painter of modern life is the artist who sort of wanders through the city and wanders through the modern world and depicts it and registers it. Baudelaire's image of the modern artist was Manet. Hamilton is very much that kind of artist. But I think he was just so intelligent. He was Bacon, Freud, great artists, his contemporaries, who are expressive artists, expressionists, you know, dealing with very visceral, personal stuff. Hamilton is a sort of more distanced, thoughtful artist who has ideas. He's an artist of ideas. And the paradox is, I think, that out of that he created, even though we think of Bacon and Freud as, you know, the painters, the great British artists, in fact, it's quite hard to identify works by them that really everyone loves and that stay in the memory banks. Whereas Richard Hamilton, who didn't play that kind of sensationalist game at all, he does stay in the memory banks. He created, sort of every decade, actually, from the 50s onwards, he created images which define it.
Rolling Stone, Mick Jagger and Mayfair Art Gallery director Robert Fraser were handcuffed yesterday during journeys between Lewes Prison and the Chichester Court. In court, Jagger wore a double-breasted green jacket, cream silk shirt and fancy grey tie. Pop idol Mick Jagger of the Rolling Stones went to court today in a lime green jacket, dark green trousers, a green and black tie and a floral pattern shirt.
Hamilton's swinging London 67 is much more than reportage. It captures the historic clash of cultures between pop and pop art and the establishment in the 1960s. It's based on a photograph taken from a newspaper showing Rolling Stone frontman Mick Jagger and Hamilton's art dealer, Robert Fraser, handcuffed together in the back of a police van, being driven from Lewes Prison to Chichester Magistrates Court following their June 1967 arrest for the possession of drugs.
And it was most particularly about the hand gestures and the way those hand gestures, I mean, it clearly demonstrated that they were handcuffed for a start, but you can interpret the gestures in different ways. Are they shielding their eyes to conceal their identity? I'm not sure they are. I think they may well be holding up their hands as if to conceal their identity, because that was the acceptable thing to do, and they were rather taking the piss out of this kind of cliched image. I mean, it was a perfectly innocuous little thing. They were having a party, they took some drugs, and the reason it's called Swinging London comes from the verdict from the judge who wanted to make an example of them and said that it demanded a swinging sentence. So there's that play between the word play between swinging and swinging.
Jagger, who was wearing a primrose frilled shirt with pleated yellow lace cuffs, put his hand to his face as he was given 3 months with £100 cost. For a moment, he looked like fainting, then prison officers moved forward to take his arms and help him down to the cells. Some girls were weeping as they left the court. For the teenagers outside, it was a black afternoon.
By the time you get to the mid-60s, you could say that Pop's innocent period, its more Edenic period, the period of the lovable mop tops, shall we say, of as the Beatles were first seen, were going. You know, it was fading fast for a variety of reasons. And the principal reason was drugs and the rise of drug use amongst musicians and within their audience. But there was also, there was a change in, you know, the decade was accelerating. The 60s were accelerating. And Jagger was possibly seen as a kind of, I mean, there's no mistake that, you know, the Stones made an album called Their Satanic Majesty's Request. You know, they were seen as these kind of aristocrats, if you want, of a pop psychedelic culture.
Richard was deeply moved by the event. He felt it was grotesquely unfair. And he did want to have an effect on the way people viewed this arrest. But he had to suppress the anger in order to do the event justice.
Richard actually bought the print of that image from, you know, the probably presumably either from a newspaper office itself or whatever. And immediately, as was his way, set about the technical requirements of how do you convert the immediacy of a grabbed lucky press shot. I mean, literally a photographer just holding up a camera and aiming at the window and hoping for the best. How do you harness the visual energy and immediacy of that image and the astonishing yet accidental combination of the raised hands with the handcuffs, the expressions on the two men's faces that they seem almost like they're laughing or smirking. How do you work with those visual components in formal terms and in technical terms to create the most powerful image?
He had such a huge influence on his peers and on subsequent generations. I mean, it's fascinating to me that students writing PhDs, even nowadays, that so many of them write their theses on Richard Hamilton.
Because Richard said about Marcel Duchamp and James Joyce, he said that their genius pervades my life. And I sometimes wondered whether with Richard, those two great minds Duchamp and Joyce sort of combine in his vision, because you have the playfulness of both, but at the same time, the technical discipline is so rigorous, it's so precise. They're all utterly aware of what they're doing. There's no chance in any of this. Although, interestingly, with Richard, he would make use of chance. I mean, famously with the Kent State images about the shooting of a student in the university in Ohio. And Richard was that evening taking photographs of his TV screen. And he just happened to hit, you know, take a photo at the moment this image came up of this poor student lying on his back. And it was an example for Richard, I think, of what he calls epiphanal thinking, that sometimes an image becomes an epiphany. And I think what he wanted to do was to investigate the workings of visual epiphany. And as an anatomist of image, you know, a dissector of image, I don't know of any modern artist who was anywhere close, quite honestly.
One day in the mid-90s, I walked into a small kind of vintage boutique gallery and I actually saw Toaster, the print, that I'd caught a kind of postage stamp reproduction of 20 years earlier. And I was deeply unsettled and shocked. That comment, people say, when you're drowning, your life goes by in seconds. I saw Toaster and I thought, oh, fuck. I've just spent 20 years reproducing Toaster.
You can find out more about Richard Hamilton and the artworks we've been discussing by visiting www.christearoberts.com.